might even put this in a circle, because I figure there's only gonna be a small group of us, so we'll see what, how this unfolds. I've been telling everyone to go to my husband's class anyway, because Brothers K is such a great book, but I also think there's a need for this, so I don't wanna lose everyone. I will go ahead and start, Jerry, or who's ever up there, David, feel free to roll the tape. That's what you have to say, because they tape record this. So anyway, it's being tape recorded. I'm Jeannie Olson, as that says. My friend made my PowerPoint. This is the first time I'm using it, so we'll see how well it works. I had three men in here helping me, so obviously I'm a novice at this. To give you background of who I am and why I'm teaching this class, being a hospital chaplain for 27 years is kind of my background. Before that, I was a speech therapist. Before that, I was an elementary education teacher. But when I found chaplaincy, I found the job that I felt like I was born to do. I absolutely love my job. I've been doing it for 27 years, as I said. To give you an idea of what I do, took clinical pastoral education for 3 years. I do on-call in the middle of the night, and on weekends we get called in for a variety of things. Deaths, somebody has to get sent to Iowa City, a baby is not doing well and needs to be baptized, somebody's being taken off a vent and they're going to be allowed to die, and so they ask the chaplain to come. A death, especially if somebody doesn't have a church, or they don't want to call their pastor in the middle of the night, then they'll call us, but we are also home in bed, so makes me kind of laugh. Right now I have, and have always, for the 27 years I've been a chaplain, taken care of all the cancer patients. So I'd say if I have a specialty, it's cancer patients. When patients were dying of AIDS, I also had all of the AIDS patients. I love the fact that I had a Jewish doctor that I worked with whenever he had an AIDS patient. He'd call me up, Olson, I've got one for you, and he realized that, you know, that the chaplain needed to be part of that. I also have the neurological floor, where we have all sorts of strokes and patients with all sorts of neurological diseases. A third of my job is also, for 45 years in our hospital, we have trained spiritual care volunteers. We call them befrienders. And there's only been 3 directors, and it's my job to recruit new people and to train them for 20 weeks, 2 hours every Tuesday afternoon for 20 weeks. And then I organize the program, and I take care of and direct and take care of all those 42 volunteers, which I absolutely love. And this class came out of that particular training that I give them. And so tonight's class is kind of the basics. And I'm probably not going to teach you a lot that you don't already know, but what I hope I'm going to do is reinforce what you know and tell you how important it is, and perhaps give you a few hooks and a few recommendations that will help you do an even better job at what you do as listeners. So I think that's all I wanted to tell you. We have been here on numerous occasions. I also have taught a class on angels and some other things. Let's see, I want to tell you anything about that. I'm just really glad you're here. I really thought maybe we'd have about 3 people and we'd sit in a circle and just kind of talk about this. So I'm thrilled that you're here. And again, the classes that we'll be following, Life Review and Reminiscing, is a huge important thing if you have older adults or someone who's dying, and we'll talk about that later. And my last class will be The Dying Patient. The philosophy of our department in the hospital that I work at it used to be an Episcopalian hospital and a Catholic hospital. And in one of those two hospitals, the chaplains would go around, see absolutely every patient, and say a prayer, try and cheer them up, and move on. That isn't the philosophy or the theology of our department, which has been going on for 48 years. Our philosophy and theology is that I don't come in to impose my agenda on any of my patients. I am there to come in, introduce myself, get permission to go in to visit my patients, and sit down. May I sit down? How are you doing today? What's on your mind? Tell me about what's going on. They tell me their story. In the telling of their story to me, I figure out how I can be of service to them. Many times it's, I need a priest, you know, I need absolution, I was in Vietnam, I haven't told my story, and that's what I need to do. That I take care of that. And sometimes it's, I come in and talk to them and find out that they will never even talk about why they're there. But they may say, my spouse died 2 months ago, and I will hear the grief story, because that's what's paramount in their mind. So my agenda is not an agenda. It's to go in and allow them to tell me what they need. So that is our philosophy and our theology, and it has worked very well for us, and I think it gives the best possible care to people rather than imposing that. And what I want to talk to you today is how important it is, because all of us have family members, we have friends, we have an older person in our neighborhood who loves to talk. We sit down at coffee at church and somebody comes over and they start telling their story. Or maybe you're one of those people who, when you go to the grocery line, there's somebody behind you and they start telling you their problems for the day. And you're going, I don't even know this person, but they're spilling out what they need to spill out, and you just must have listener written across your forehead. And I'm here to tell you, especially as people of God, how I think that's so important as we live out our faith. That one of the ways we live out our faith is that we are companioning people on whatever journey they're on and augmenting and being present to. So that's my goal this evening. And that in the telling of the stories comes healing. And I'll explain more of that. But in the telling of the story comes healing. And it's pivotal. The telling of the story is pivotal to anyone. Whether they're in a spiritual dilemma, a physical dilemma, an emotional dilemma, in the hospital, in a nursing home, growing older, it's pivotal to their understanding of themselves and the journey that they're on. There's also bad listening. And to begin with, I'm going to read you a story, and I got it on the internet, and you know, you think, okay, it says it's a true story, is it? Whether it's a true story or not, there's truth in this story, and these things happen. So here's the story. The Beach, a True Story. How many of you have heard it? Oh, good. All right. She was just 6 years old when I first met her on the beach near where I live. I drive to this beach a distance of 3 or 4 miles whenever the world begins to close in on me. She was building a sandcastle or something and looked up, and her eyes were as blue as the sea. Hello, she said. I answered her with a nod, not really in the mood to bother with a small child. I'm building, she said. I see that. What is it? I asked, but really not caring. I don't know. I just like the feel of the sand. That sounds good, I thought, and I slipped off my shoes. A sandpiper glided by. That's a joy, the child said. It's a what? It's a joy. My mama says sandpipers come to bring us joy. The bird went dancing down the beach. Goodbye, joy, I muttered to myself. Hello, pain, and I turned to walk on. I was depressed. My life seemed completely out of balance. What's your name? Oh, my gosh, she wouldn't give up. Ruth, I said. I'm Ruth Peterson. Mine's Wendy. I'm 6. Hi, Wendy. She giggled. You're funny. In spite of my gloom, I laughed too and walked on. Her musical giggle followed me. Come again, Mrs. P. We'll have another happy day. The days and weeks that followed belonged to others. A group of unruly Boy Scouts, PTA meetings, an ailing mother. The sun was shining one morning as I took my hands out of the dishwasher. I need a sandpiper, I said to myself, and I gathered up my coat. The ever-changing balm of the seashore awaited me. The breeze was chilly, but I walked along trying to recapture the serenity I needed. I'd forgotten about the child and was startled when she appeared. Hello, Mrs. P, she said. Do you want to play? What did you have in mind, I said, most irritated. I don't know, you say. How about charades, I said sarcastically. The laughter burst forth from her. I don't know what that is, she said. Let's just walk. Looking at her, I noticed the delicate fairness of her face. Where do you live? I asked. Over there, she pointed to a row of summer cottages. Strange, I thought, in winter. Where do you go to school? I don't go to school. Mommy says we're on vacation. She chattered, the little girl talk, as we walked up the beach, but my mind was on other things. I left for home. Wendy said it had been a happy day. Feeling surprisingly better, I smiled at her and agreed. 3 weeks later, I rushed to my beach in a state of near panic. I was in no mood to even greet Wendy, and I thought I saw her mother on the porch and feeling like demanding her and saying, "If you don't mind, I need to be alone." Wendy caught up with me. "I'd rather be alone today." She seemed unusually pale and out of breath. "Why?" she said. I turned to her and said, "Because my mother died." And I thought, "Oh my God, what am I saying to this little child?" "Oh," she said quietly, "then this is a bad day." "Yes, and yesterday and the day before, and oh please, did it hurt?" she said. "Did what hurt?" I was exasperated. "When she died." "Of course it hurt," I said, under misunderstanding and wrapped up in myself. I walked off. Mother, so after that, I went to the beach again. She wasn't there. Feeling guilty and ashamed, I admitted to myself I missed her. I went to the cottage after my walk and knocked on the door. A young woman came with honey-colored hair and said, "Hello." I said, "Hello, I'm Ruth Peterson. I missed your little girl today and wondered where she was." "Oh, Mrs. Peterson, please come in. Wendy talked of you so much. I'm afraid I allowed her to bother you. If she was a nuisance, I apologize." "Not at all. She's a delightful child," I said, suddenly realizing that I meant it. "Where is she?" "Wendy died last week, Mrs. Peterson. She had leukemia. Maybe she didn't tell you." Struck dumb, I groped for a chair, my breath caught. She loved this beach, so when she wanted to come, we couldn't say no. She seemed so much happier here, and a lot of what she called happy days. But the last few weeks, she declined rapidly. "She left something for you. Let me see if I can find it." I nodded stupidly, my mind racing for something, anything to say to this young woman. She handed me a smeared envelope with "Mrs. P." written in bold, childish letters. Inside was a drawing of bright colors, a sea, a yellow beach, blue sky, and a brown bird. Underneath was carefully written, "A sandpiper to bring you joy." Tears welled up in my eyes and a heart that had almost forgotten how to love. I took Wendy's mother in my arms. "I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry," I muttered over and over, and we wept together. The precious little picture is framed now and hangs in my study. 6 words, one for each year she had life, speaking to me of harmony and courage, undemanding love, a gift from a child with sea blue eyes and the color of sand, who taught me the gift of love, and I added, and taught me how to listen. Powerful story, but I think powerful stories make points, and we don't forget them, because powerful stories make us realize that there are times when we perhaps have missed hearing an amazing story because we are much too busy and our lives are much too crazy. Sometimes there is bad listening. This is another incident of bad sleep. "How are you?" "Well, my foot is..." "Oh, look what time it's getting to be." Nobody really wants to know how you are. I have been trying as a hospital chaplain. We all do this, right? We're passing somebody in the corridor of someplace. We say, "Hi, how are you?" And we just keep walking. And I think, how stupid is that? Why do I say that to someone when I don't have the time because I'm rushing to a code blue in the emergency room? Why do I say that? So I've been trying to train myself not to do that, because sometimes bad listening is what happens when we go from one place to another very quickly. Or sometimes bad listening is I've stopped listening but you're still talking stare, and we're thinking about the grocery list that we could be making, and somebody's going on and on and on in a monotone, and we really don't care, but it's just a sound that we hear. And then sometimes it does happen. Little Linus, I think that's Linus, right? The little bitty one? Yeah. He's got his head down, and how is school today? I failed story listening. And what I teach my befrienders, our volunteers, is when you're here for the 3 hours a week that you're here, you cannot fail story listening, because the folks that we're going to see need to be able to tell their story. So what is the story that we're trying to help people tell? I believe in illustrations because I, for one, learn best if I have a visual. So that's why we have little cartoons, which I love, and that's why we're going to have this visual. What is our story? The first part of the story are facts. When you meet someone for the first time, you get the facts of their life. "My name is Jeannie Olson. I'm a chaplain. I live in Bettendorf, Iowa. I have a spouse who's teaching next door. I have two sons who live in the foreign country of LA, and I drive a Prius, and I'm 100% Norwegian. Okay, is that my story? No, that's just the facts, some of the facts of who I am. So what's the next layer of the story as you're meeting with someone and getting to know them, or maybe you're visiting someone from your church who's now at the nursing home? So the next layer of the story, I can't do anything close to this computer because it's Jerry's computer and I want to stay very far away from it with any elements of life. So I think I better take out my Norwegian here. All right, so this is part of my story. What's the next level of my story? It's my hopes and my values and my dreams and my experiences and goals. Okay? All right. Is that my whole story? No. What permeates all of our stories, I really want to keep this away from his computer, what permeates all of our stories, thank you, is what holds us all together, especially people of faith. It's our faith. It's our relationship with God. It's the core of who we are, and as you can see, it goes down and permeates absolutely everything. And when we want to hear the story of another human being, we want to go down into those levels, because just to know the facts about me doesn't tell you much about me. Just to know my dreams and my values doesn't tell you much about me. But when I start to connect with you about how I feel about God and my faith journey, and that puts it all together and permeates all of it. And the story always goes much deeper. A story is, and I'm sorry this isn't clear, I'm not sure why it isn't, Hi L, better for worse than my favorite cartoon. Hi L, I haven't seen you for a few days, how are you? So kind, my mom's not well, they're talking about laying off some people at work, my back's been bothering me, Elizabeth's moods are driving us all crazy, and on goes the conversation. Look at the wonderful exchange, how they're looking at each other. We're going to talk about that later. The story goes on. She said, a good friend is someone who listens after they ask, how are you? Unlike the other cartoons that I showed you, where they don't take the time to listen. When I teach our befrienders, volunteers, how we're going to go in and present ourselves, whether it's to people in nursing homes or whatever, and my, of course, background is hospital patients, I use this graph because it really puts in their mind what they want to do when they're visiting someone. When I go into a room, perhaps I'm going to know this is Mrs. Smith, she has leukemia, she has a spouse, she goes to St. Paul Lutheran Church, and she's 35 years old, let's say. I get facts. When I sit down with her and say, hi, how are things going today? She's probably going to start with some facts. I have leukemia, and I've already gone through this, and now I'm doing that. And maybe I'm going to get facts about her illness. Maybe I'm going to get a fact that she has the most wonderful husband in the world and a great support system. I'm going to get facts. As she's telling me those, I may also ask her a feeling question. You just told me that you were only diagnosed 3 weeks ago. Or maybe I'm talking to someone and their spouse has died and said, this has to be really hard for you. You know, what feeling are, you know, where are you on your journey of this? And she's going to go in, or he's going to go in, to the feelings. But I have some questions that would help bring us to that feeling level. I may say to someone, is this the worst thing that's ever happened to you? Has anyone in your family ever had their leg cut off or whatever the situation may be? Oh yeah, said one of my patients to me. You know, my dad died of cancer and it was 30 years ago. And goes on to tell me the scenario of how awful it was. 30 years ago, medicine in the cancer area was far worse than it is now. And what she says to me as she's telling me about the facts and the feeling and the history is, what I'm most afraid of, Jeannie, is the pain, because they never controlled his pain. I'm not afraid of dying. I'm a person of faith, but I'm afraid of the pain. What have we gotten in that story? A whole bunch of what's going on with her, you know, the feelings and the frustrations, some of the anger and so on. But what I've discovered in this area is what I need to tell, do I have your permission to tell the doctor that? And have you addressed the doctor with your major concern, which is pain? No, I haven't. Well, let's think about that. So we do that. What happens to most of us when we're listening to people is this what's happening. First of all, this journey is really pretty hard. You're going to visit somebody from your congregation and they have now moved into the nursing home, or they're a member of your church and you're sitting with them at coffee, and they get into their grief story, whatever the grief is. And it's oftentimes a very sad story. People are carrying around a lot of pain. I think we are the walking wounded. Almost everyone is dealing with something sometime. What happens to most of us when we're listening is we do this. Someone starts telling us the facts of whatever drama and situation they're in, and we get anxious, and so we leapfrog, if you can read this, to quick fixes. Oh yeah, I had that problem, and this is what I did. And we try and give a quick fix to what we think will solve their problem. People we love do this the most to us because they don't want to see us hurting. I have a dear friend, and when I'm having a terrible day and I'm ranting and raving and I know I have to tell my story and I have coffee with this person, and she'll interrupt my story and she'll tell me how to fix it. You have a friend like that? More than likely you also have a family member that does that. And those are the worst, because the people that love us the most don't want us to be in pain. And so they want to fix it. They want to fix it. The other thing they do is give us cliches. Let's think of the times you have had a funeral and someone has come up to you, and this is a significant person in your life, and says, now, some of these may work for you, and I may be offending you by the ones I'm going to say, but I'm going to say them anyway, and you can figure out how to work with her. You can attack me later. But someone says to you, well, God doesn't give you more than you can handle, you know. Really? How about the people in my psych ward who have tried to slip their wrist? Really? God doesn't, that isn't my theology. So if you give me a theology that is not my theology, are you helping me by giving me your theology? No. Or someone will say, well, God only takes the best, you know. Really? Really? I could give a whole class on the cliches I hear at visitations and funerals and grief groups. They're just awful. I remember a little boy who was, his sister had died, and he was in this line as people were going through, and the well-meaning person went through the line and said, well, God always takes the best, you know, and he's standing there thinking, really? Mm-hmm. So she was the best, and I'm not, and I don't want to die. So, and he becomes a little hellion, and mom and dad never figure out why, but he doesn't want to be the best because he doesn't want to die like his sister did. I mean, these cliches are very, very destructive. Or we give the solution. Really, you have that cancer doctor? Well, I'm not sure you want that cancer doctor because it'll get really hot if you close that. So you may not want to do that. And so I say to my befrienders, you have insurance. You are covered by our insurance. But if you are going to go in and give a patient advice on what doctor they should have and what chemotherapy they should take, or if you're doing that or someone is doing that to you, do you really want to be responsible for the decision they make that you suggested? Now, this morning in the Bible study, I just love the fact that, her name Marty?
Yeah, Marty
said something about she had someone who came to her and asked advice. I've been a chaplain, as I said, for 27 years. Hardly anyone asks advice. They really just want to tell their story. But this person did, and in her dealings with that person, she said, what did she say? Do you remember? I asked her questions. I asked her questions. And that's what I teach our volunteers to do. Ask questions, and I'll explain why that's way better than giving solutions. So the essence of what we want to do here is, even though this is not comfortable listening to some of these stories that people are going to tell you, family members or whatever, we have to allow them to tell the story. You know how the Psalms go? They rant and rave in the Psalms, God, where are you when I need you? And have you deserted me? And life is terrible and I'm in the pits and where are... This is what happens at the end of those Psalms, and about two-thirds of the Psalms, at the end is, but God is with me, and I know you're there, and I'm grateful for your presence. But they had to tell the story before they came to their own conclusion that God is there. And that's what I believe happens when we're good listeners, is the story is told, we go down into the pit, and everything's dreadful, but in the end, the The transformation comes when we allow them to go through the whole process themselves. A story to show that. If there's some of this left, I'm going to have to drink the sand. I worked with one of the cancer doctors, and he said, "Chaplain, I need you on this one. I have a dreadful situation. I'm going to go talk to a lady. She has cancer. She's going to have surgery tomorrow, and her husband is absolutely no help to her." He sits in the corner of the room, and he laughs. I'll be giving her dreadful news, and he'll laugh. He's going to be no help to her whatsoever. He must be the most awful husband in the world. So come on along. So as we're going down the corridor, the husband comes along, and Dr. Zaint says, "This is Jeannie Olson, the chaplain," and I put out my hand to shake his hand, and he takes my hand, and he laughs. Well, I know there's nothing funny. I mean, I don't think I look funny, so I don't think there was anything funny in the situation, but I knew instantly, and you all know somebody, that when they're uncomfortable, they laugh. So we went into the room, the doctor's talking to the patient, and sure enough, the gentleman's sitting over in the corner, and the doctor's telling her dreadful things about her surgery and her cancer, and a little laughter comes from the side of the room. Doctor leaves, I spend some time with the patient, I ask her if she would like a prayer, etc. The next day, I know she's having her surgery. So I go in the surgical waiting room. It's a very tall, thin man, and his physical appearance is like this. He's just sitting hunched over, looking at his hands, wringing them. And I slide up next to him, and there's lots of people around. And I ask him a few questions, and it's really going nowhere. He's extremely shy. And I finally said to him, "Ed, how'd you meet your wife?" "Well, she was 16 and I was 23, and she was still in high school, and we had started dating, and our parents weren't sure they liked that, and finally we wanted to get married, and we had to ask her," and all of a sudden he starts talking fast, and then he becomes animated, and he stops at about 14, 15 minutes later and goes, "I don't know why I'm talking to you. I never talk to anybody about anything, and I don't know why I'm talking to you. I said, but you're doing a beautiful job, and I just want to know more. Now tell me about the children." So he goes on. So for another 15, 20 minutes, and he stops again, he goes, "You don't understand, lady. I really don't talk to anyone." I said, "But now what about," and he went on when I asked the next question. About 40 minutes into this, he slows his speech down, and he said, "Chaplain, ever since she was 16, I've taken care of her. I've been able to fix everything that needed to be fixed in our family and protect her. And now I feel hopeless and helpless because I can't fix anything. I can't fix this disease." And in the middle of this gigantic room, surgical waiting room, he starts to weep. It was, any of my befrienders could have done this, any of the other chaplains. I'm not telling you the story to tell you I'm a good chaplain. What I'm telling you is I believe we learn by story. But there was the story of, what did I do? I only created safe space. And what I've discovered is that many times you can talk to someone, what's that for? Oh, thank you. You can talk to someone who's not a family member way easier than someone who is a family member. I don't come in with baggage. You, as a person who sort of knows this person in church, or sort of knows this person you're supposed to call on, or a colleague who comes up to you in the lunchroom, they feel safe with you if you create that safe space, and if you ask questions, and if you're not judgmental, and if you really truly want to hear the story. And so that was what was true with Ed. When his wife did die, and I will do anything to get out of a funeral because I hate doing funerals, but I knew that these people were in church, and I knew that I knew the situation better than others. And whenever I would see him, he wouldn't talk to me. If I was in the room with any other family members or his wife. But if I saw him in the hallway or I would sit down with him in the lounge, he would talk. And he processed more and more feelings. And then, as I said, she died. When I went to the visitation, his son came up to me and said, "You don't know me, but I'm his son. And when he told you he doesn't talk to anyone, he was not kidding. We don't know the feelings he had inside us and never have as his kids." And his grandson came up to me, who was 12, and said the same thing. Again, it wasn't about me. It was about creating that space and allowing him to tell the story by asking the right questions.
So that's the wounded healer model. If I could, one thing to take from this is, please, most of the cliches you know, forget them. You know, just let them go, because they're probably not going to do much good. So, yes?
Could you just read the words on the lower part?
Oh, yes. Anxiety in the telling of the story, but in the telling comes transformation. So in the telling of the story, you know, there's lots of anxiety for the person listening and the person telling the story. But in the end, like in the Psalms, there's that transformation. And does it happen all the time? No, but that's hopefully the goal of what you're trying to do.
If you're listening to a story somebody wrote, so how do you come to a conclusion? Like, how long do you let that go? Or
now, truly, I will say, we need to know. We all know somebody who abused the listening that we give them. You know, we kind of, and I say to my befrienders, if you feel like they're repeating the story and you're being abused as a good listener, you need, you obviously have to leave at some point. But it's interesting because you see, let me give you an example. One of the examples I have here is I went in to visit a patient and she had been told by her doctor she had to move to a nursing home and move out of her house. Well, when you're 88 years old and you've lived in this house for 50 years, and someone tells you you got to move out of the house, I mean, she was angry, and she had lost her leg. And so I said, tell me about your life, because she had to make a decision. I said, tell me about your life. What's important, and who's your family, and what's your support system? So I asked her a bunch of questions. She started telling the story. Her husband had died 2 years ago. She had 3 children. They all lived out of town. She lived in a house that she was caring for and still mowing the grass at 88 years old. But she said to me, you know, I've loved being independent. My kids are out of town. They can't take care of me, and I don't want them to. And I can't mow that grass. But I want some independence, and I still have a lot of good life in me. I think I do need to move into a facility where they can take care of me, but I can also be independent. But she came to that transformation. When she came there, I said, it sounds like you've decided what you need to do. And she said, yeah, it did. So you kind of know when they have come to that. In the class about the dying patient, I'm going to talk about a time when the person was dying, and I said, what do you need in order to die peacefully? And she listed the things. And when she was done talking to me, she closed her eyes, and I knew she was done with me. So, you know, there are some times that you just know. Obviously, every scenario is different, but yeah, I'm not sure I can answer that, but I think it's just you learn as you do it. Yeah, yeah. Good listeners aren't problem solvers. I think we've all in our ministry because we are. There's no greater agony than bearing an untold story within you. I love Maya Angelou, and I love the fact that she tells this. And think of the time in your life when you've had something really going wrong. If you just kept it all inside, what happens? Well, our stomach gets tied in knots, and we get migraine headaches, and we can't eat, or we sleep too much, or we start drinking too much, or whatever it is we do. We have to tell our stories. And we know that when things like that are happening in the family, those family members have to tell the story. So I think that's a pretty powerful statement. There's no greater agony than bearing an untold story within us. But until we process that, we really can't go on and get stuck. And so I love her wisdom there. Henry Nouwen, of course, when many of us have been studying him in our churches all along the way, and so I absolutely love his example there, a friend who can be silent with us in a moment of despair or confusion, who can stay with us in an hour of grief and bereavement, who can tolerate not knowing, not curing, not healing, and face with us the reality of our powerlessness. That is a friend who cares. And I think that takes a lot of restraint. As I retell the story of my friend who always wanted to give me a solution. We don't like to see people that we love hurt. I think the best example of good listening comes again from Better for Worse. And this is my all-time
favorite cartoon on what it's like to be a good listener, okay? If some of you read this one, so you know this cartoon. Okay, his wife has just died, and he is now at his daughter's house, and the funeral is over, and he's laying in bed and says, "Every day I try to look happy. I try to be funny. I try to cope, but I miss you so much, Marion." We know that people who are in grief end up talking out loud or thinking out loud. They can't sleep at night. The other side of the bed is empty. All of these things are going through the survivor's head. "I feel like a kid again, lost in a big, strange bed, afraid to be alone." He's actually even talking about the feelings that he's having. He's acknowledging it. So what happens? Edgar comes to the doorway. Now, if you're a visitor for your church and you're going to the nursing home and you knock on the person's door, you need to be acknowledged and to be welcomed in. And I think that's important. These people have to want you to come and visit them, right? And Edgar knows that he needs to have permission to go any farther. So, well, hello, Edgar. How are you doing? And Edgar puts a paw up on the bed, which says, "Can I come farther? You know, am I invited in to your space?" You want up. You're not supposed to be on the bed. But now Edgar is licking him. I don't suggest that we do anything like that. And if the person is somebody we know well, we can certainly give them a hug or a little kiss on the cheek, but not always, right? Fine, if you insist. So Edgar gets up on the bed. Again, I tell my befrienders, you are not to sit on patients' beds. That is their private space. But pull up a chair next to them, very close to them. Because if you're calling on someone and you're standing over them, that's a position of authority, and that doesn't say, "I'm here to be present for you." So sitting down is really important when you go visit somebody. And then he starts to tell a story. "I was just about to spend another miserable night feeling sorry for myself." Now, Edgar is a great listener. Because what does Edgar do? He gets physically close, and he looks at Grandpa. He gives him his full eye contact and attention. How did you know? I mean, Grandpa is acknowledging this beautiful presence. So, Edgar, what's next? What am I going to do with my life? Edgar's still watching, and Grandpa has reached out to touch Edgar. There's times when I visit a patient and I pull up a chair, I'll put my arm on their bed, especially if it's an older person or a person I know is in a lot of grief and turmoil. I'll put my arm very close or on their bed, and it's amazing how many people, especially if they're older, will reach out and take my hand because they need that physical contact of somebody who's not only present, but I can touch them. So, Grandpa has reached out. Do I go home and live in the little house in British Columbia, or do I move in here with my daughter? Now, Edgar happens to know that this is the most important question that Grandpa is dealing with. So what does he do? He perks up his head, he turns his head, he looks him straight in the eye, because that's the pivotal question in this conversation. Edgar's wonderful. And Grandpa says, "But I guess I don't have to make that decision now, do I? I have enough to deal with just as it is." And he still has his hand on Edgar. There's nothing like talking things over with a friend. I just love this cartoon. You know, when they say dogs are man's and women's best friends, there's something about that that's really very true, because we can talk to them and they don't talk back. So how many times, and when I find out somebody is a widow or widower and they have a cat or a dog, I say, "Oh, you know, that's just the most marvelous thing, because I hope you talk to your cat or dog and they're present with you and they meet you at the door and they wag their tail and so on." But I just love that. And then he feels at peace because he's come around, told the pain, and now he can relax and say, "Yeah, I don't have to deal with that right now. I have to take care of something else." That's my all-time absolute favorite. Rachel, Naomi, and I think it's pronounced Remen. Anyone know that for sure? Is it Remen or Remen? I think it's Remen. Okay, no one's going to know, so I'll just say Remen. I love her. She has written Kitchen Table Wisdom and My Grandfather's Blessing. Some of you have read that and are nodding. And I love her because she's an MD, so she understands the medical aspect of illness. And she has Crohn's disease. So
So she knows what it's like to be a patient. She knows what it's like to be not listened to as a patient. And so she's written these two books, and what I also love about them is they're, a chapter will be 3 or 4 pages, kind of a vignette of her life. And she imparts such wisdom. And her grandfather was a rabbi, and so she has a beautiful Jewish background and grounding and foundation of her life. So she's the patient, she's the doctor, and she's a person of faith. And in her book, Kitchen Table Wisdom, she talks about she was on the faculty of Stanford Medical School. She was going to a workshop that Dr. Carl Rogers, the humanistic psychotherapist, was going to be teaching a class. And he was going to be teaching a class on unconditional positive regard. And these are littler letters. Okay. And so in the audience, in this circle of physicians, they were all physicians and Dr. Carl Rogers, and he asked for a volunteer to as he was going to work out this unconditional positive regard. And so unconditional positive regard came down to, and this is the definition, to sitting in silence and accepting everything the person said without judgment or interpretation. I could not imagine how this might prove helpful, said this medical doctor. And so he was going to do this demonstration. This doctor came and sat in the middle with all his colleagues around him. Then Rogers began to speak. Before every session, I take a moment to remember my humanity. There is no experience this man has that I cannot share with him, no fear that I cannot understand, no suffering that I cannot care about, because I too am human. No matter how deep his wound, he does not need to be ashamed in front of me. I, too, am vulnerable. And because of this, I am enough. And that's one of the things I want you to remember and take home with you. If you're making some of these calls and you're having some conversations with whoever, here at the Village, too, and you think, oh, my gosh, I'm getting in too deep here, remember, you're enough, that mere presence. I am enough. Whatever his or her story, he no longer needs to be alone with it. This is what will allow his healing to begin. The session that followed was profound, as Rogers, without saying a single word, conveyed to this physician, simply by the quality of his attention, the total acceptance of his and his story. The doctor began to talk, and the session rapidly became a great deal more than a demonstration of a technique. In the safe climate of Rogers' total acceptance, he began to shed his masks, hesitantly at first, and then more and more readily. As each mask fell, Rogers welcomed it, one unconditionally, until finally we glimpsed the beauty of the doctor's naked face and story. I doubt that even he himself had ever seen it before. What Rogers was pointing to, of course, is a very wise and basic principle, is the healing of a relationship by telling the story. Whatever the expertise we have acquired as physicians, she's saying, the greatest gift we bring anyone who is suffering is wholeness. Listening is perhaps the most powerful of all healing tools. It is often through the quality of our listening and not the wisdom of our words that we are able to affect the most profound changes in the people around us. When we listen to a person's story, we offer our attention for the opportunity for wholeness. And I love the sentence. Our listening creates holy sanctuary. How powerful and spiritual a word is that? Holy sanctuary for the homeless parts within the other person, which have been denied, unloved, devalued by themselves and others, that which is hidden. Last sentence. Listening creates holy silence. When you listen generously. People can hear the truth in themselves, often for the first time. When you asked, how do you know, and I showed you that graph, and it comes up the other side, and that transformation, that's what happens when the telling of the story goes deep into the valley, but starts to come up on the other side. As you tell your story to someone, as someone tells their story to you, your inner wisdom, I would define it as Christians, as the Holy Spirit. but it's also your own inner wisdom. Someone else giving you advice isn't the same thing. I wonder how many patients say, well, I don't know what I'm going to do with my family. You know, I've got one son in Florida, and he tells me to do one thing, and I have a daughter in British Columbia, and she tells me to do something else, and somebody else in Florida, they're all telling me what to do, and nobody's listening to me. I find it sad and unnerving that someone could have made wonderful decisions for 85 years in their life, and all of a sudden we treat them as children. Now, if there's dementia or Alzheimer's, that's one thing. But these people have made those decisions, and how dare we try and tell them what to do? I say to someone, if I have a daughter or son who comes to me and says, we need to do this, I say, have you ever thought of just saying, Mom, what would you like to do? What do you think could be good for you here? Instead of telling someone what to do, what if we said, Mom, tell me what you think would be good. How would you feel safe? How would you feel comfortable? Where would your needs be met? And if the patient, the person you're talking to or whatever, can tell you, then they've saved their own dignity and they feel like they're still in control of life and we're not treating them as children. I want to save room for questions. I'm going to do this quickly now. How are you perceived as a listener? This statistic, I wish I could tell you where it came from because I know that's the professional thing to do, but I don't have it, so I'm going to give it to you anyway. 55% of how you're perceived as a listener is, anyone want to guess? What? Body language. Yeah. Body language. Can you believe it? I mean, that's amazing to me. Body language is how you're most perceived as a listener. Are you sitting back and looking at the ceiling? Are you like Edgar, moving in, touching, giving eye contact? That's why Edgar is so fabulous. He does all of that. He moves in, gives good body language, he looks, he touches. Body language. The next one that I heard blew my mind also. The second most important thing is the tone of your voice. Is the tone of your voice. Who knew? Who knew? The tone of your voice. Does it sound compassionate and gentle and sympathetic? Or does it sound judgmental and I have the solutions here and you're being a fool? And tone of voice. The last thing is words. Now, those of you in the group who are professors and preachers and make a living giving words, you do that because that's what you need to do. But in the setting of someone telling you their story, that's probably the last thing you want to do. I want to tell you a quick story. My CPE supervisor, my mentor, my best friend, who was a chaplain with me, told me a story of when he went to the emergency room, and there was a 35-year-old woman, and her husband had been in an automobile accident, and the doctor came in to tell her that her husband had died. And Rick did all the things you're supposed to do as a chaplain, being present with the family, having a prayer, taking the family in to see the body, helping them call a few, all the things that we as chaplains do. But she got a thank you note 3 weeks later, and she said, the thing I remember most that got me through this is that you stood behind me and you had your hand on my shoulder. That's what allowed me to go through the most awful time in my life. You had your hand on my shoulder. It wasn't his prayers, though as an Episcopalian priest, he gave beautiful prayers. It wasn't the things he did by bringing in and allowing her to see the body of her husband and saying a prayer over him. I just think how much that says about the power of listening. I did have a befriender who came down to me one day and he said, oh, chaplain, I just did a terrible job. I have to tell you. I said, well, tell me the story. What happened? You went up and visited somebody. What happened? He goes, well, I went in and I visited her. I said, hi, my name is Roy Schaefer and I'm a befriender. And may I sit down and how are you doing today? He said, so this patient looked at me and said, hi, I'm George. And he started telling me his story. And he said, He was a German, he has a thick accent, and he started telling a story, and he was talking so fast. He said, I got the word Alcoa, and I got the word wife, and I think there were some children, And I got the word illness, but I don't know what it is. And he said, but he talked so fast, and I got these words. And then all of a sudden, he slowed down about 20 minutes later, and he said, thank you, Royce, for hearing my story. You are such a good friend. And Royce said, I knew I was done, and I could leave. I go, oh, thank you very much for telling me your story. He said, Jeannie, I don't know what the story was. And I said, does it matter? Does it matter that you don't know the story? Or is what matters that he got to tell the story? And obviously, it was a huge story. I said, how did you keep it going, by the way? And he said, oh, I did everything you taught me to do. When he looked sad, I looked sad. And when he looked happy, I looked happy. And I just kept looking him right in the eyes, and I said, that's the best befriending story I have ever heard. And he said, and he had this sigh of relief that he had, in fact, that it didn't matter, but he had, in fact, heard, had, in fact, been present to the story. When I was taking CPE, one of the chaplains that I worked with, who knew his Greek quite well, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. And when he said, Jeannie, now some of you have had Greek, so you can tell me if I'm saying this right, but he said, that's translated differently in Greek. It says, fortunate are those who go through deep emotional pain, hurt. It isn't just grief when we get this. It isn't just grief. It's any emotional hurt. For they shall have a called person alongside. I love that. Because that's how people get through the grief. Is there's a called person. And how many times are you going to be that person who's called alongside? We studied for 2 years. We had this group called Spiritual Care, and had some longer name. But for 2 years, we brought in speakers every 2 weeks to find out, how can we make the world a better place? You know, is it these organizations? Is it pouring money into this? Is it food pantries? Is it, we studied it all. Is it education? We studied it all. At the end of 2 years, what we learned is, if you want to change the world, if you want to make the world a better place, you do it one person at a time, at being called alongside. You've got somebody in your life, I bet, that you know, that is a troubled soul, or is just going through the loss of a spouse, or has a kid who's giving them fits. And it's those people who come alongside and say, tell me how it's going today. And then we sit, we hear the story. And then that person has somebody else. My husband and I lost 2 best friends this year. One of them was 70 and would walk into a room, and the whole room became energetic and loving and funny, and he was just amazing. And he's gone. And so there are a variety of us who come up alongside his wife and say, let's go out to lunch today. And then she'll tell me what part of the grief that she's in. A month before we came here, my other best friend's husband died very quickly. He was one of those people who hiked the mountain trails all over the place. Very good shape. What do I hear happening as I'm calling back home? That one friend is bringing her dinner on Monday nights, and another friend is meeting her on Friday mornings for coffee. They are called people alongside. And the word for that is parakaleo. Am I saying that right for anyone who knows Greek? Parakaleo? Okay, it's another thing you don't know, so I can just say it. That's right. But that's the called alongside person. And I guess that's my hope for all of us, is that if you can remember one thing from here today, it's that you are called. That we as people of our faith, and I think that's one of the things that Christ asks of us, to be that person called alongside. Questions? I've done too much talking. Yes?
Can you apply this to family? If you are the mother whose kid is giving you fits, how can you be the mother who walks alongside?
Exactly. The hardest. The hardest. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. This is all the hardest to do with your own family. Mm-hmm. Always. And so that's why you hope that there's somebody else who can do it. But what I've also discovered is the thing I said a little bit ago, is that instead of sitting down and saying,
sometimes it doesn't work, though. Tell me about your day. Or just asking the question and seeing where it goes and not giving the advice we would love to give our children to make their lives easier. Being a parent is the hardest thing I've ever done. I can be with dying people all day long, but being with my kid and helping him through the difficulties of his life. But I think not giving advice, how many times when you give advice, they go, and off they go, right? That's exactly what happens to us when we give advice to our kid. They don't want to hear advice. What they need to do is tell the story and figure it out themselves. What would you like? And we, of course, it would all help. If I had had this training before I was a parent, I'd have been a way better parent, you know, because I would have said, well, tell me what's going on and how do you think you can fix that? How do you think you can fix that? Rather than my giving it advice. It's hard. And sometimes you just hope and pray that there's somebody else who will be that parakaleo and come alongside, because we can't be it. We're their mom. Mom, I don't know how many times I've said that, your kid says it to you, mom. Yeah. So then you pray for that person. You see who he perhaps or she likes best. And then the bottom line is, their journey is just difficult. Yeah.
I also heard one time, I read one time that they say with teenagers, if you can't say anything that they'll accept, that to not forget to touch them. Yeah.
Even though they make all.
What you said. Yeah. But they said as long as you know, daily contact with them.
Absolutely. And that they know in the midst of all this they're loved unconditionally. Yeah.
I've been through that stuff. And you can't change anyone's behavior, kids or anyone. The only person's behavior you can change is your own. And if you do, everyone has to change their behavior also. Mm-hmm.
Good point. Beautiful. Thank you. Are you a child psychologist or something?
No, I'm someone who's gone through a lot.
You have it by experience, and that's probably the best teacher of all, is that you've been there.
About 6 years of tough love.
Oh, that's hard stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's
the hardest thing we do.
But it is. It's exactly this, because you go into a group of people, and they listen to your problems, and you listen to theirs, and then the wisdom comes out from yourself.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm wondering if this falls into cliches, but because you shouldn't use cliches, but I found with my kids that that must be hard. It was a good way to get them talking, or you look like you had a hard day.
Oh no, those aren't cliches. Those are great questions. I mean, you're opening space for them to tell. No, that's great.
That's why my son always said, I'm not a talking boy.
Right. But at least, even if they don't talk, they know that you realize it's hard. You're acknowledging the pain they're in, and sometimes that's all it takes.
I think that the one thing that sometimes I've done really wrong is if my daughter thinks that I am, like, feeling how she's feeling, I mean, like, she feels bad, so then I'm going, oh, like sympathizing or taking on her feelings.
Mm-hmm.
That's not good.
Yeah.
She wants.
She wants you to be her.
She wants a mother.
Yeah, she wants mother. But saying that's saying what she said, that's must be hard for you.
Yeah.
You look like you've had a hard day,
or
whatever. You know,
yeah.
Acknowledging you're perceiving it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Jen.
What is that? I mean, I can understand, like, people who've had something clammed up and they get to tell their story. It just feels better. There's, like, acknowledgement or release or, like, figuring something out through the telling of it.
Mm-hmm.
But could you say something more about, like, what is happening that being
good question. And as someone else said to me today, I'm trying to cram a week's worth of things into an hour. So I have left a lot out. But I think what happens is, for example, let's do a grief story. Someone's telling and retelling a story.
someone's died and they're going through the visitation and the funeral, and they tell and retell the story. First of all, I think what telling and retelling it does is it clarifies it in your mind, yes, my spouse really did die. And I'm having to come to the realization of what's happened, because it seems like it can't have happened. It's making whatever is happening real. So that's one thing that happens. It also happens when someone's trying to figure out, okay, my spouse has died, now what do I do? Do I move in with my daughter, or do I do this or do I that? As you tell the story, you figure out what your priorities are. So that is happening too. As I tell the story and I'm hearing myself tell it, yeah, it makes a whole lot of sense if I've got my leg cut off like the lady did, that I move to a nursing home. So it helps you sort out things. And then actually, too, what I didn't bring up is when you tell a story physiologically, your body relaxes because you've been heard. And so I tell the story, and I'm so frustrated, and I'm so angry, and I'm so whatever, and you hear people say, I feel so much better having said that. I mean, literally people say that to me in the hospital. I feel so much better. I felt like I had an elephant on my chest, or my stomach was tied up in knots, or I had such a headache. But it's like this release of, and people in hospitals anyway, they use the call button less. They feel less like a number or an illness, and they feel like they have heard, they're looked at and viewed as a whole person. So I think there's a lot of things that happen. They feel cared about, and because who of us would want to go through a tragedy all by ourselves? So we feel companioned. When we feel companioned, the bell's going to go off, so I'm going to let you go. But there's a variety, emotionally, socially, physically, all of those. Things are affected in the telling of the story. So I believe in starting on time and ending on time. I want you to be able to get to chapel. Thank you for coming, and I hope you'll take one thing away that you can use.